This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Heart of Blood and Ashes by Mila Vane, narrated by Nicole Poole. Chapter 1. Matic.
Commander!
A young Sicilian soldier called out as Matic rode toward the bridge. Something's got the savages on the run! Her polished helm gleaming beneath the early morning sun, the soldier pointed across the river. Matic slowed his mare, gaze scanning the opposite bank. This was a grim stretch of the lave. On either side of the swift-flowing waters, sparse grasses grew on stony ground that buckled and heaved into hills and ravines. The Farian's hunting party was camped in one of those gullies, hidden from Matic's sight, though he knew well its location and had posted soldiers along the river banks, eyes covering every route out of the ravine that the savages might take when they finally attempted to cross. Covered in the mud they painted over their translucent skin, now Farian scrambled their way out of the ravine using all of those routes, but not in concerted attack. Instead, they were as gutworms wriggling free of infested dung tossed on a fire. Some carried spears and spiked clubs, but most had no weapons, as if they'd been surprised in camp and chose to run rather than arm themselves. Faintly, Matic heard their urgent hoots over the rush of the river.
A trap jaw?
Matic asked Keeler as the warrior rode up alongside him. If one of those giant predatory reptiles attacked the Alliance army camp, Matic would not have reprimanded any soldier for fleeing there, too. His second captain cocked his head, dark braids brushing his shoulders.
Too quiet.
So it was. A trap jaw was silent until it rushed its prey. Then it often loosed a trumpeting roar, one that would have reached them even over the sound of the river. A handful of savages scuttled nearer to the bridge as if preparing to escape across the water, though this side of the river was no safer for them. 2 dozen of Matic's mounted Parsathian warriors and a handful of soldiers waited to separate the Farian's hairless heads from their hunched shoulders. In nearly 8 years of holding the Farians at the lave, Matic had seen savages run toward death many times. Never had he witnessed a Farian flee from anything.
"There it is!"
a soldier cried out, coming up the stony path out of the ravine. A Siva beast. Matic exchanged a look with Keeler as the soldier snorted with laughter. Though as heavy as a yellow tusker and as tall as a mammoth, a Siva beast was docile as a milk cow. Usually it waddled along, a plated dome of armor over its humped back and protecting the sides of its belly, using hardened beak and curved claws to rip open rotten logs and dig up roots. Yet there were few roots and logs here. The jungle where the Siva beast must have wandered from was 3 days' ride downstream. A hard, bloody journey for the Siva. Gaping wounds on its leathery neck and legs showed signs of attack. Gore dripped from its beak, as did green foam. Matic tensed.
It is poisoned.
Keeler had seen the same.
Silek venom.
Stung by one of the 2-armed serpents that swam the lave, the Farians had been right to flee. That venom first weakened the serpent's prey so it could be dragged from the riverbanks and drowned. Most animals stung by the serpent didn't escape. And those that didn't truly escape. They only staggered away until the weakness put them to sleep, and they woke as if brainless, unfeeling of pain and killing everything that moved. Eventually they starved or died of wounds. But the Siva's armor protected it from an easy kill, particularly from the Farian's primitive spears and clubs, so the best chance of survival was to stay out of its sight. The savages weren't out of sight yet. If the Siva made noise, Matic couldn't hear it from this distance. Silently it charged, tearing open a savage with curved claws as long as daggers. Its strong beak crushed another Farian's leg as the savage tried to run away. Matic heard those screams. He also heard a young Gogian soldier nearby, his face bloodbare as he watched the beast attack the Farians.
So we let the Siva kill the savages for us?
He looked to his companions hesitantly, as if uncertain whether to be glad the beast tore their enemy apart. Although that question hadn't been directed at Matic, he answered it.
Then wait for it to attack our camp. It does not care if we are Farian or human. It will kill us all,
he said.
There are enemies and there are monsters. Always slay the monsters first because enemies may one day become allies, but monsters never will.
As the Gogian soldier would have looked upon Matic as an enemy only a generation past,
perhaps even thought him a monster. Color stained the young soldier's cheeks as if realizing the same. Maddock drew his sword.
Keeler?
The warrior hefted his axe.
Ready!
To the soldiers, Maddock said,
Hold the bridge while we are across.
He took a dozen Parsathian riders with him. Their hooves thundered across the stone bridge. Immediately, the Siva found new focus, growling wetly as it charged Maddock and his warriors. Had Maddock known he would be facing a beast maddened by Silac venom, he'd not have ridden his favorite mare to the river this morn. Yet there was reason she was his favorite. Though tall and muscular, as all Parsathian steeds were, she was also nimble as an antelope. With the barest signal from Maddock, she dodged the Siva's swiping claw. As soon as they were past the beast, the Siva's attention shifted to Keeler and the warriors behind him. Maddock's mare swiftly pivoted and sprang forward with a powerful thrust of her hindquarters. The Siva's soft belly was too low to the ground to offer a real target. Any warrior low enough and close enough to cut it open might be crushed when the beast fell dead. Yet Maddock had seen that every time the beast struck with its foaming beak, first it reared back its head. Sword in hand, Maddock launched from his saddle. The Siva's neck muscles bunched as it prepared to snap at Keeler. A grunt tore from Maddock's chest as he swung at the beast's exposed throat, laying it open with one powerful slice of sharpened steel. Blood jetted from the fatal gash. Narrowly, Maddock avoided a blow from flailing claws, rolling out of the way across the hardened ground and coming to a quick stop and a crouch, face to face with a Farian that hid from the beast behind a nearby boulder. Muscles coiled, bloodied sword in his hand, Maddock made no move. The Farian held a bone blade in its long-fingered grip, yet the savage also remained motionless, near enough that Maddock could feel the hissing breath that issued from between its pointed teeth. Mud covered its pale face. The savage's large ears shifted subtly, no doubt tracking his warrior's movements by their sound. All had fallen quiet behind Maddock, waiting for his signal. A signal would not come. He'd given an order that as long as the savages remained on this side of the river, the Alliance soldiers and Parsathian warriors were not to kill them, except in defense of their own lives. Maddock cared not if the Farians overran the territory south of the Lave, from the bone fields to the salt sea. He would leave them in peace. Yet if they crossed the Lave, they would die. Many did die, but this one hadn't lifted its blade toward Maddock, so it would not. Slowly, Maddock backed away, gaze never leaving the crouching savage. His mare nickered softly behind him. Eyes still on the Farian, he swung up into his saddle. Keeler laughed at him as they rode toward the bridge.
Now you wait for that savage to attack our camp?
Poking at him with the same words Maddock had said to the young soldier. Maddock grinned, for despite Keeler's teasing, he knew that the warrior would have made the same choice. Perhaps the savage would cross the river with intention of raping and killing every human it encountered. But Maddock would not kill even a Farian for what it had not yet done. If the savage crossed the river, however, then Maddock would tear its head from its shoulders. His attention was caught by the mounted figure watching them from the opposite end of the bridge. Enox, his first captain, who ought to have been at camp sleeping in her furs after a night spent along the river. Silver beads glinted in her dark braids as she cast him a dour look.
1,000 warriors you have at your command. Could you have not sent them to kill that beast instead of taking it upon your own head?
Never would Maddock send warriors into a battle he was not also willing to fight, nor would Enox. If Maddock had not been upon the Lave this morning, it would have been she who led that charge and felled the maddened Siva.
Warriors accompanied me across the bridge, he pointed out. It is no fault of mine if my mount was fleeter than theirs.
Her snort echoed Keeler's, yet she had not come to reprimand him, Maddock knew. Drawing his mare alongside hers, he asked,
What brings you?
Dagona has arrived with a company of Tolehi soldiers, she said, reining her horse back toward camp. And a message for you from the Alliance Council.
Maddock frowned and urged his mare to keep pace.
What message? He would not give it to me, but is waiting to speak with you.
Unease slithered through his gut. Not many years ago he'd delivered a message from the Alliance Council, too. Maddock had assumed command at the Lave 8 years past. In the 6 years following, not once had Maddock journeyed home to the Burning Plains until his parents had requested from the council a 3-year leave so that they might find him a bride and see him married. In his absence, Iova of Rugus had assumed command of the Alliance army.
Before even three seasons had passed, however, the Alliance Council bade Matic to return to the river with a message for Iova. The Raguzian king was dead, and to resume command while that realm's affairs were sorted. Iova was to have returned when all was settled, yet despite the passing of a winter, she had not. Now the Alliance Council sent another message, and Dagona would not tell Enox what it was. That could not bode well. Yet Keeler's mind had taken a happier route.
Perhaps they have finally found you a bride.
His parents. Though Matic had returned to the lave, a bride for him they'd still intended to find, one who might strengthen ties between Parsath and the five realms that made up the Alliance, a royal daughter or a noble woman. Very likely a woman like Iova, who was not only a fine soldier but also aunt to the dead Raguzian king. If Iova had been younger, or if she'd had a daughter, Matic suspected that he would already be married. For all that it would be a marriage designed to strengthen the Alliance, however, never would his parents choose a bride unsuited to him. Though finding a warrior among the noble houses might prove too difficult a task, no doubt she would be honest, never lying or speaking with sly tongue, for she would become Matic's closest advisor. If from Tola, then she would be educated by the monks, with a mind both clever and fair. And as befitted a woman who might one day be a Parsathian queen, and if she wished to gain his mother's approval, she would be tall and strong and a skilled rider and possess a heart that burned with fire. Such a woman Matic would be eager to meet and take to his bed. For he'd been celibate after assuming command at the lave 8 years past, mindful of his parents' warning that when the High Commander of the Army of the Great Alliance asked someone to share his furs, there was not much difference between an invitation and an order. And during his short return to the Burning Plains, he'd taken no lovers, not when his parents were already seeking a bride. Touching anyone else seemed a betrayal of the vows Matic would make to that woman, and it mattered not that he hadn't yet met her. A fine thing it would be to finally fuck something softer than his fist. So, it was with anticipation that he rode into camp, where Parsathian tents made of mammoth hides and tusks housed the Alliance army. Dagona had brought with him 100 soldiers, as if expecting Matic to leave with a large number of Parsathians, as Matic would if there was to be a wedding. Yet there was to be no wedding. He entered the commander's tent with Keeler and Enox at his sides, and one glance at the Tolehi man's face told Matic that he was not to receive news about a bride. Dagona still wore his armor, yet had removed his helm, revealing his shaven head, and certainly he looked to Enox and Keeler before returning his solemn gaze to Matic's.
Perhaps we might speak privately, Commander.
As if fists had clenched around his lungs, Matic told him tightly,
There is nothing you can say that they cannot hear.
Yet what Dagona did say, Matic seemed not to hear, not through the roaring in his ears. Yet Enox must have also heard what Matic could not accept. Fiercely she advanced on the captain as if the sheer threat of her approach might force him to retrieve what he'd said and shove it back into his mouth.
That cannot be truth, Enox spat. It cannot.
It is.
Grave and steady was Dagona's reply.
Ran Eshev and Ran Merek have returned to Mother Temra's embrace.
Ran Eshev and Ran Merek. The Parsathians called them their queen and king. Matic called them mother and father. All fierceness leaving her, Enox fell to her knees on a keening wail. With her fists, she pounded the ground as if she might reshape the world, as Mother Temra had, as if she might shake her queen and king free of that goddess's eternal grip. A harsh, sobbing breath came from beside Matic before Keeler threw back his head. The warrior's howl of grief sounded as if torn from a bloodied throat. Matic's own howl swelled in his chest, yet it seemed there was no release for it, the grief too deep, a cavernous hollow that had suddenly opened within him.
How?
So empty was his voice, he knew not how Dagona heard it. Yet the captain must have. With grim regret, the other man shook his head.
I have no answers for you. My message and orders from the council were so bare, I suspect they were sent to Tola in great haste.
And the messenger knew nothing more?
Matic asked hoarsely.
Only rumor that your queen and king were killed in Sicia. But I know not if it was bandits or beasts or illness, whether in the city or the outlands.
Voice deep with apology, Dagona spread his hands.
I am only to assume command here and send you north to Efhorn.
To stand before the Alliance Council and learn what had killed his parents. what had killed his queen and king. In his heart yawned a great and painful emptiness, yet unreal it all seemed. Madoc knew the dangers that might befall a warrior, but could not imagine what had befallen them. His queen and king had been so strong and such clever warriors. Unbelievable that they might survive Anumith the Destroyer only to be killed by bandits. So he would demand answers of the council, and if it had been bandits, Madoc would hunt down every single one of them. Answers and vengeance. It seemed that purpose was all that moved his feet. Each breath was hot, shuddering agony. Madoc emerged from the commander's tent, and a blurred sea of Parsathian faces was all he saw, warriors drawn by the sound of Enox's wail and Keeler's howl. 3 times he tried to say the words that needed to be said. Each time they broke on his mother's name. Yet it was enough. Understanding and grief slid like a blade through the warrior standing before him, shearing hearts open as Madoc's had been. On a deep breath, he gathered that purpose again. Answers. Vengeance. If they were to be had, then Madoc would have both. In stronger voice, he called out,
"Riders of the Burning Plains, make ready to fly north!"
The Parsathian army started out silently on their journey, grim-faced and grieving. Riding hard, never did they pause to hunt for meat or furs. Their saddles were their dining halls, the cold ground their beds. Even battle-hardened muscles ached, yet no complaints had issued from the warriors' lips. As the days passed, grief softened and song returned to the Parsathians' tongues, ballads that spoke of lusty warriors and legendary rulers, and of the goddess Temra, who had broken through the vault of the sky and reshaped the world with the pounding of her fist, forcing life to sprout from the earth's barren face. Temra, whose loving arms welcomed the souls of the dead back into her eternal embrace. But silver-fingered Rani had carried Madoc's parents into Temra's arms too early. Though sorrow lay like stone upon Madoc's features, even his granite mouth smiled again when the warriors told their ribald jokes, though his deep voice did not lift in song, he felt the rhythm through his blood like the beat of war drums. But his grief did not soften. Instead, the burning need for answers and vengeance hardened around his bereaved heart like steel. A full turn of the moon passed before the white stone wall surrounding Ephorn's great city became visible in the distance. Madoc often heard Ephorn's soldiers claim that glimpsing the walled city from across the plain was akin to gazing upon a shining mountain. Madoc agreed that Ephorn could be mistaken for a mountain. A pale, squatting one, built upon a hill of its own dung. Walls should not swell any soldier's breast with pride. Those walls symbolized fear, not strength. Ephorn and the cities of nearby realms had built their walls because they feared each other and feared their common enemies, the Parsathian riders to the north and the Farian savages to the south. Yet the walls had not stopped generations of rulers from conspiring and warring among themselves, had not prevented the Parsathians from invading and raiding their cities, and had not saved them from the Farians who raped and slaughtered their citizens. And a generation past, those walls had not stopped Anumith the Destroyer, who'd crushed the city's stone defenses as easily as he'd torn the hide tents in the Parsathian hunting camps. Walls were not strength. The alliance that had formed between the riders of Parsath and the 5 southern realms in the wake of the Destroyer, that was strength. That alliance was also why Ephorn's gates opened for Madoc upon his approach. The city that would have barred a Parsathian's entrance a generation ago now invited him in. The citizens would not as warmly welcome the Parsathian army that rode behind Madoc, however, so only 3 warriors accompanied him. Beneath the shadow cast by the white wall, sallow-cheeked children played between mud-brick houses that only saw the sun at midday. No breeze stirred the stale air, but for the wind created by the swift passing of Madoc and his warriors, their mounts' hooves clattering on the cobblestone road. Visible beyond the clay-tiled roofs rose the shining blue spires of the citadel, and it was at the citadel where the splendor of Ephorn was put on display. In the great courtyard beyond the fortress's outer gates, lush gardens breathed their perfume into the air. Fountains splashed into gleaming marble basins. Market stalls boasted pots full of colorful spices and hung a dazzling array of silks. At the open tables, mead flowed like rivers to wash down mountains of roasted meats. It was the city that never hungered or thirsted. Some said Muda herself favored Ephorn, so its fields always yielded a bounty and its wells never ran dry. Madoc could not claim to know whether the goddess of law cared for crops and water, but he thought her favor had been helped along by Ephorn's location. Centered among the four other southern realms that made up the Great Alliance, Ephorn had not been raided or attacked as often as the cities on the borders. And most roads, along with the trade they brought, took a central route through the region instead of crossing Parsathian or Farian territory, so the merchants of Ephorn bought from foreign traders on the cheap and sold their wares to the other realms at a profit. But perhaps they called that the goddess's favor, too. Madoc passed through the citadel's inner gates and dismounted at the base of the Tower of the Moon, the tallest of the four great towers within the fortress. With sheer walls of seamless white marble topped by a sapphire spire that pierced the sky, the tower had served as the royal keep until the destroyer had slaughtered the royal family. Afterward, though many nobles still lived, no one had taken the king's place on the throne. Instead, the city had come under the protection of the court of Muda, and the fortress became the seat of the Great Alliance. Here, Madoc would find the answers he sought. He glanced over at Keeler, who still sat on his horse. The big warrior's head was tilted far back as he took in the height of the tower. A doleful expression settled over Keeler's scarred features when he noted Madoc's gaze upon him.
"I have held the tales of Ranbantik close to my heart since I was a boy. One day I would have told them to my own children, but now I know them all to be false."
Tales of the legendary thief king of Parsath, who had long ago united the tribes that rode the burning plains.
Why false? No one could have scaled those walls to steal the pearl from Ephorn's crown. Easier to scale a wall of greased steel. So it would be, but a man does not become a legend by performing feats that others deem easy,
Madoc said.
Climbing that wall would not be difficult. It would be impossible.
Madoc agreed, but a man also did not become a legend by doing what others deemed possible.
Is the feat not as impressive if he climbed the stairs?
How can it be? Shall I tell my children how Ranbantik gasped for breath when he reached the top? Shall I describe how he must have clutched his burning chest as he stole the pearl?
If Commander Madoc were to race to the upper chambers, he would not be gasping for breath, and neither would I.
This came from Ardal, who had also dismounted and now looked up at Keeler with a frown creasing her black-painted brow.
Perhaps if you more often ran beside your horse instead of always sitting on him, you could also reach the top unwinded.
Keeler looked to Madoc as if for help, but Madoc had none to offer. Instead, he could only laugh his agreement. Keeler's saddle would wear thin before his boots ever did.
When I see the keep, I do not think of Ranbantik, Ardal added as she took Madoc's reins.
The warriors would not accompany him inside, but would remain in the courtyard with the horses.
Instead, I wonder what sort of fools the royal family must have been. They built a majestic tower honoring the moon goddess, though it is by Muda's favor that they all prosper.
What insult could that be?
Keeler frowned at her.
Vila gave birth to Muda. What daughter would not see her mother honored?
Ardal's response was a glance at the silent warrior mounted a few paces behind him. Danal's feud with her mother was almost as legendary as any thief king. Many Parsathians claimed the only time they'd ever heard Danal speak was when she yelled at the older woman. Grinning, Keeler bowed his head to acknowledge Ardal's point. Movement on the tower steps drew Madoc's attention. A seneschal in blue robes approached, a wiry Tolehi man with shaved head and pursed lips. Omer. Madoc knew him well. He'd first met the seneschal as a boy, visiting the tower while his parents spoke to the council. He'd spent a full morning in an antechamber with Omer, watching him as an antelope watches a drapa, with trembling limbs and pounding heart, fearing the raptor's sickle claw that would spill steaming innards to the ground. Though a sickle claw from Madoc's first drapa hunt had already hung from the leather thong around his throat, he hadn't spilled the Tolehi man's innards. Instead, he'd eaten his way through a platter of roasted boa. Madoc had pleasant memories of that morning, and of every meeting since, even if the seneschal did not.
Commander Madoc.
Omer imperiously swept his hand toward the tower entrance.
The council is ready to receive you, if you are ready to be received.
The doubt in the seneschal's tone suggested that Madoc could not be.
I am.
The older man sniffed as Madoc joined him.
If you wish, I will escort you to the bathing chambers first.
Grinning his amusement, Madoc climbed the steps.
I do not wish.
There was no shame in smelling of horse or in wearing the grime of camp on his skin. The duty of serving the Alliance and protecting their people left his warriors covered in sweat and filth, and he would not pretend a warrior's work was a clean work.
As it was, the council ministers should be grateful he always washed away the blood of battle, or he would have faced them dripping an ocean of it. With a sword's worth of steel in his spine, Omer tipped back his head to meet Maddox's gaze.
I would offer a robe so that you could clothe yourself before meeting the ministers, but we do not have any large enough to cover your mountainous expanse of flesh. But did I not see a mammoth's pelt rolled up and tied to your beast of a horse?
Not a mammoth's, but a bison's, and it was too warm for furs. The last frost had melted during their journey north, and Maddox no longer used his furs except to sleep on. He said simply,
I am already dressed.
In red linen, folded over a wide belt. The inner length of cloth hung to his knees. When it was raining or cold, he could draw up the longer outer length and drape it over his shoulders, but now it fell almost to the ground, all but concealing the soft leather boots that protected his feet and hugged his calves. The outer length of linen was split to allow for ease of movement, but unless he was riding or fighting, it concealed his skin as well as a southerner's robe did, from the waist down. On this day, the sun was high and warm, so he needed no other covering, whereas Omer wore enough for two men. The southerners did not just wrap their cities in walls. Their soldiers wrapped their bodies in heavy armor, even when they were not in battle. The citizens wrapped themselves in cloth from neck to ankle, even on days when they needed no protection from the cold or wind. An entire life they spent wrapped, as if for a funeral pyre. Maddox spent his life as he lived it. For a full turn of the moon he had been traveling, so he was dressed to ride. He did not anticipate a fight, so he wore no armor and his chest was bare, aside from the leather baldric slung across his shoulder to carry his sword. No black paint darkened his brow. The only silver upon his fingers was the family crest circling the base of his thumb. He tucked away the razor-tipped claws that would drip with blood by the end of a battle. Although he was a commander of the Alliance's army, if Maddox had arrived looking as he did after a battle, he doubted they'd have let him through the gates. Many southerners within the Alliance still believed the Parsathians were little better than the Farian savages. The riders were still called raiders and thieves, and uncivilized. Maddox had never known the raid. By the time he'd been old enough to mount his first horse, the alliance between Parsath and the southern realms had been firmly established. But if civilization meant cowering behind walls, if it meant wrapping every bare stretch of skin in linens, then Maddox preferred to be a barbarian. In a god's age, when their civilized walls were crumbling to dust, when the names of their civilized cities were forgotten, Parsathian seed would still grow strong amid the ruins. Omer gave Maddox's bare chest a despairing glance before sighing and continuing across the marble floor inside the tower's entrance. In silence, they walked until they reached the anteroom outside the council's chamber. Then the seneschal quietly said,
It is with great sorrow that I learned what befell Ranashev and Ranmerek. They were always the most welcome of the council's visitors. Of those who knew them, there can be not one who does not grieve for them now.
Maddox inclined his head but made no other response, except in his gratitude to draw the red cloth up over his shoulder and drape it across his chest. He had not yet learned what had befallen his parents. Maddox would not press Omer for answers, however. The questions that burned within his breast would be asked within the council chambers. Nothing had been left unasked or unsaid between mother and father and son. Every Parsathian warrior knew life was too uncertain to leave important words unspoken. And since leaving the lathe, much time had Maddox to think upon what came next, beyond answers and, if needed, vengeance. To think upon what his parents would have wanted of him. When Maddox had last seen them, his queen and king spoke of finding him a bride and of strengthening the alliance between Parsath and the southern realms. Nothing was left unsaid, but there was much left undone. So, Maddox would see it finished in their stead.
Chapter 2 Maddox. The tower's former throne room lay beyond gleaming doors carved from ivory. Such a grand entrance had likely once opened into an opulent royal chamber, but the council's was starkly decorated. Instead of a throne, six bone chairs sat behind a long crescent table. Those chairs did not belong to any one minister. Like the moon, their position shifted, so that no member of the alliance always sat in the center or at the ends of the table. Each member had an equal voice and a council minister who spoke on behalf of their home. The alliance between Parsath and the southern realms formed after the destroyer had marched through these lands. Former enemies and rivals, Now they were bound together by a common purpose, not to stand against the destroyer. It had been too late for that. But to stand against the warlords and sorcerers who sought to conquer the shattered remains the destroyer left in his wake. But for one, the same minister sat on the council as the last time Matic had come before them. On the far left was Nail. The Parsathian minister also only wore a cloth over his belt, with a longer length draped over his shoulder, but Matic doubted that Omer ever chided the older man for his lack of clothing. A queen's age passed, in battle against one of the destroyer's warlords, Nail had lost his right hand, and a poisoned blade had withered the strength on his left side. He'd stopped wearing a warrior's braids and had grown his beard long. Yet his quiet and formidable power never waned, and his patience and loyalty were endless. For those reasons, Maddox's parents had considered Nail their closest friend and advisor. They had fought the destroyer together and helped form the alliance together. Now the older man's expression brightened at the sight of Matic, but grief lay heavily on his lined face, and he appeared to have aged 10 years in the 3 seasons since Matic had last seen him. Matic bowed his head in Nail's direction. In his role as an alliance commander, he should not show more respect to any one minister over another, but he did respect Nail above all others and would never pretend otherwise. Beside him sat the Gogian minister, Kintus, whose sharp expression often matched the words on her scythe of a tongue. As the southernmost realm, Gog would suffer more than any other if the Farian savages were not checked, yet its every contribution to the alliance had to be pried from the woman's begrudging fingers. Unlike Parsath, where everyone was taught to ride and hunt and fight, in the southern realms only a small number of citizens became soldiers. So the cities contributed a few squadrons to the Alliance's army and made up the difference with goods that the council deemed were of equal value. For Gog, that meant sending grain for every Parsathian warrior and horse. Kintus looked upon Matic now with a bitter scowl, which he imagined was the same face she would wear if anyone requested air to breathe while they passed through Gogian lands. But he would ask nothing of her. Everything his army required while traveling through Ephorn would come from the woman to her right, Pella, Ephorn's minister and one of Muda's high priestesses. Pella did not sit on the court while serving on the Alliance Council, yet her gray hair was still sheared closely to her bronze scalp. Over her wrapped linens she wore Muda's robes. The heavy cloth dyed the deep orange of that goddess's ever-changing and ever-burning fire. Thin gold chains circled her neck, her wrists, and her ankles, signifying the law by which she was always bound. Yet those chains were malleable. Pella herself often seemed forged of steel, and Matic appreciated her all the more for it. He could not feel the same toward the Sisian minister who claimed the seat beside her. Bazir had been appointed to the council by his father, Sisia's regent king. Bazir's moonstone eyes also marked him as a son of the house of Niset, and a descendant of that great Sisian warrior queen, but there was nothing of a warrior that Matic could see in him. Bazir had strength enough in his linen-wrapped limbs. He had skill with a sword and upon a horse, but he had not a warrior's plain speak. His tongue was as slick as his blue silk robes, and his every word stank of indolent rot. He had not a warrior's honor, which demanded that he fight in service of his people. Instead, he was driven by self-interest, just as his father was. From the moment Jalan had married the last living daughter of Niset's bloodline, his seed had corrupted Sisia's ruling house with selfish ambition. Jalan did not look upon Sisia's abundance of riches as a gift from the gods, as did the rulers and citizens of Ephorn. Instead, the regent king took Sisia's wealth as his due, owed to him by virtue of his superior position and birth. So did his sons. Bazir gazed upon Matic now with his usual unconcealed disdain, a disdain that frequently deepened to frustration when Bazir realized his opinion touched Matic not at all, except to amuse him. As if Matic would ever be touched by the contempt of an overindulged sly tongue. If the Parsathian still raided their neighbors, Matic often thought he would lead his warriors against Sisia first, simply to watch disdain give way to terror in Bazir's pale eyes. That would amuse Matic even more. Never would he ride against the man at Bazir's left, however, Gareth, the Tolehi minister who'd served as a captain under Matic's mother in the Alliance's campaign against Stranix Fang. With steady hands and a steadier heart in battle, Gareth had also proved himself a quietly stubborn and thoughtful addition to the Alliance Council, and it was his son Dagona who had taken over Matic's command on the lave. Matic was unacquainted with the last man at the table, Rugus's new minister was hardly more than a boy, but Madoc needed no name to know who he was. Those moonstone eyes spoke for him. So did Pella.
Commander Madoc, you have not yet met the newest member of our council, Lord Tizen of Rugus.
Of Rugus now, but originally of Sissia. With those pearlescent eyes, Tizen must be brother to Bazir, and also brother to King Ezil, who had gained the Rugusian throne following King Layton's death by poison. That king's murder had not been discovered, but everyone who spoke of it suspected that Ezil had been responsible. So now two of Jalen's sons sat upon the council, and another son ruled Rugus, and their reigns were held by the regent king of a rotten house. This could not lead to the stronger alliance that Madoc's parents had been fighting for. With calm elegance, the youth inclined his head toward Madoc.
Commander.
Madoc merely looked upon him. Though as tall as his brother, with the same dark hair and bronze skin, Tizen did not appear to have even reached his bearded age. Perhaps he fully shaved his jaw, as most Parsathian warriors did. But Madoc suspected that nothing yet grew in. Eyes ghostly pale, the boy regarded him with undisguised curiosity, as if oblivious to the insult of Madoc's silence. His brother was not oblivious. Bazir's disdain darkened to anger, a flush rising over his cheeks. Smoothly, Pella spoke before Bazir could.
"We mourn your queen and king with you, Commander Madoc, and we are sorry a messenger could not have been more fleet."
Madoc bowed his head.
"Silver-fingered Rani has flown them back into Temra's arms, so not even the swiftest horse could have changed their course, Lady Pella. It is as it is."
And there was a distance to be crossed. The news had to travel from Parsath to Ephorn, then from the council to the banks of the Lave. A full season would pass between his parents' death and Madoc's return home. That could not be helped. Yet now he could finally learn what had befallen them. He looked to Nail, but before Madoc could speak, Kintus's sharp voice pulled his attention to her.
"We knew that you would return home upon receiving word, Commander, but we did not expect to see an entire army behind you. Have you withdrawn every Parsathian warrior from the Lave encampment?"
Madoc met the Gogian minister's gaze squarely. She would demand this answer of him now, before he could speak another word of his queen and king. But a season had passed since their deaths, and Kintus already knew what had happened to his parents. Those questions would not burn in her mind as brightly as they still did in Madoc's, and when Kintus looked at him, she likely saw him only as the Alliance's commander, not a son. So he swallowed his questions for the moment.
"I have."
"Why would you do such a thing?"
Irritation tightened Nail's weathered face as he looked to the woman beside him, but it was Pella who said,
"Lord Nail has already explained that every Parsathian must be present when their tribes gather to choose their new Ran, so that they may raise their voices in support or opposition."
That did not satisfy Kintus of Gog.
"Could not the warriors have sent word of their choice instead? Could not the numbers have been taken at the encampment and counted among the voices?"
Madoc stared at her, disbelief and disgust rising sour to his tongue.
"You would have me toss each warrior's voice into a sack like a kernel of corn and carry it north so that it arrives indistinguishable from the voices I carried with it?"
Perhaps that was what civilization meant. In the southern realms, their kings and queens were chosen for them. Individual voices mattered little. But if civilization demanded silence, Madoc would never see the same happen to Parsath.
"They all come."
Though his tone must have told her the matter was closed, still her mouth opened again. Gareth of Tolle stepped in.
"The boundary was not left undefended, Kintus. When we sent the message to Commander Madoc, my king also sent 100 soldiers. Even with the Parsathians absent, there are still a large number of Alliance soldiers at the encampment, including a squadron of your own Gogian warriors. Their number can hold the river."
Kintus's bitter gaze swung back to Madoc.
"And if the savages come in such great force that they overwhelm that number, what do we do then?"
Anger fired his tongue.
"Then you will do as you have done for ages and cower behind your walls," he told her.
Her eyes snapped wide and she looked to Nail in outrage, but Madoc had not finished his answer.
"You ask what to do? The savages will never stop coming and they will never gather in such numbers that we can destroy them all. They will always be a threat. Yet Gog does not have enough soldiers to fight them, even though you have had a full generation under the Alliance's protection to grow and harvest new warriors. Instead, you made them into farmers and relied upon another wall. A wall constructed of Parsathian flesh and mortared by Parsathian blood. You did nothing to strengthen your own flesh and blood. I suggest you begin.
We did nothing?
Her thin lips pinched, two dull spots of color burnishing her cheeks. You look well fed, Commander. Your giant horses appear fat, and the grain you gorge yourselves on is our flesh and blood, you reeking brutish.
Kintus!
A sharp word from Pella stopped the tirade. Her steely gaze met Maddox's.
In your opinion, Commander, are the defensive forces on the river sufficient to counter the savages' attacks?
They are.
If they hadn't been, Maddox would have requested more forces before leaving. Pella accepted his answer with a simple nod.
The agreement between our people states that each member of the Alliance must be allowed the opportunity to settle their affairs and to establish new rule when internal disruptions of this nature occur. Following King Leighton's death last summer, the Ragusian commander left the Lave encampment early, as did most of the Ragusian soldiers. That ruling house is now settled, so Rugus can send additional reinforcements to the Lave until the Parsathians have settled their affairs and their warriors return.
A self-satisfied smirk curled Bazir's mouth, his moonstone gaze smug as he regarded Maddox.
Rugus is under another obligation, providing guard to the Sissian court, he said before looking to Pella. The council approved the contract, do you not recall? It was only done this past winter.
I recall the contract. She frowned at Bazir before looking beyond him to his brother. Can Rugus not spare a company of soldiers, Tizen?
Solemnly, the boy shook his head. By all appearances, he was at ease, yet his hands were curled into fists, his knuckles white.
Sissia's regent has recently demanded that my king's every available soldier be sent to his city.
Bazir's pale face flicked to Maddox again.
We believe the extra guard will be necessary.
The heavy silence that fell across the ministers then felt like a burden of things undone. It weighed hard and sudden upon Maddox's heart, and for a long breath, that great muscle seemed not to pound. Then it began beating again, faster and hotter. He looked to Nail.
What fell to our king and queen?
He asked, and his voice was quiet, but every Parsathian knew that quiet simply preceded the rage of a fire, the fury of a storm, the clash of a sword. He saw the hardening of Nail's face, the rage already burning, but it was not the warrior who answered him. Pella said,
Before we begin, Commander Maddox, you must understand that all has been satisfied by Alliance law.
What has been satisfied?
Not he. Eagerly, Bazir leaned forward to tell him.
This winter past, your queen and king came to Sissia to discuss strengthening the Alliance through your marriage to one of my kin. While there, your king assaulted a woman of the household and was slain when my father defended her honor.
Without haste, Maddox started for him. Bazir scrambled back, bone chair clattering to the floor in his rush, his pale eyes finally darkened with fear. But the sight didn't amuse Maddox as he thought it would. Instead, he only saw red. He did not reach for his sword. He left his silver claws tucked away. With bare hands, he would tear this liar's head from his neck, rip out his sly tongue, and stuff it down the ragged, blood-spurting hole of his throat. The crescent table stood in his path. The ministers were already scattering. Gareth thrust the boy behind him as if to use his own body as a shield against Maddox's wrath, and Pella grabbed Kintus's arm as if to haul her away before the table was shoved aside. But Maddox simply leapt onto the carved surface, then over, his muscles coiled like steel springs, his gaze fixed on Bazir's blood-bare face. The man's pale eyes darted right and left, searching for escape. Instead of escape, came rescue in the form of Nail's wasted hand upon Maddox's arm. Nothing else in that tower could have made Maddox pause. Only out of the deepest respect did he halt. And Nail knew that halted was not stopped.
If you value your life, leave us!
He snapped at the cowering Bazir. As if Nail was uncertain of the depth of Maddox's rage, the warning in his gaze shifted to the brother.
Leave us, Tizen.
Maddox would not have touched the boy. Any fool could see that the youth had not shared Bazir's smirking pleasure when his brother had spoken the foul lie. Instead, he'd turned his face away, as if shamed. Ashamed of his brother or ashamed of what their father had done, Matic cared not. The boy would have neither brother nor father to be ashamed of much longer. A murmur from Pella sent Gareth and Quintus from the chamber after the two brothers. With blood rage in his eyes, Matic's gaze followed Bazir's hasty retreat through the ivory doors. The sly tongue's escape now mattered not at all. Matic would find him again. He would rip that lying tongue from between Bazir's smirking lips. He could hardly believe that it hadn't yet been done. With a throat scoured raw by grief and rage, he looked to Nail.
"You were friend to my queen and king. Tell me why he still lives. Tell me why Jalen does. It could not be my absence that stayed your hand. You would not wait for me to avenge their deaths and to silence the lies that would stain their names."
"There will be no vengeance," Pella said, but Maddox's gaze did not stray from Nail's face.
"We could not prove any lie. Indeed, part of the story was corroborated by a minister on this council."
"A minister?"
An incredulous sneer twisted Maddox's mouth.
"Jalen's son?"
"By me."
The older man's eyes were steady on his.
"Your parents came to me and asked what I knew of the House of Nyset. They had received a message from a woman within the household that put forth the possibility of marriage to unite our people."
"And what did you tell them?"
"To avoid Sisian royalty as they would avoid a nest of starving Drepa. But your parents said they knew what Jalen and his sons were, and went."
"That is only corroboration that they journeyed to Sisia, not that my father assaulted a woman."
Simply speaking the words was like acid burning Maddox's tongue. His father would never touch a woman other than his mother. To do so would be to betray his vows and be known as the most cursed and cowardly of all warriors, an oathbreaker. Pella shook her head.
"The incident was also witnessed by the Rugusian guards."
"And upon Rugus's throne sits Jalen's murdering son, who has most reason to support his father's lies. And you say this matter is satisfied? It is not satisfied."
Nor was it in Nail's opinion, Maddox saw from his face, yet the older man still held his arm, still held him back.
"What of my mother? Was she also murdered by these treacherous curs when my father was?"
For she would have fought to the death at his side, or to avenge him. Renewed rage sparked in the older man's gaze.
"She was held as an assassin and interrogated for 3 turns of the moon before she tried to escape."
Interrogated? Matic could not speak.
"She killed Jalen's eldest son during her escape attempt,"
Pella added solemnly.
"Her sentence was the same as any who had been found guilty of assassinating a Sisian royal."
"What sentence?"
he asked hoarsely.
"Beheading."
Matic closed his eyes. His queen, his mother, bound and beheaded, forced to endure not a warrior's honorable death but a criminal's shameful punishment. Not a single wall would be standing in Sisia when Matic was done, not one. His eyes opened.
"I will have Jalen's head."
The man could hire every guard and mercenary from every realm west of Temra's ocean. It would not save him.
"You cannot seek vengeance for this,"
Pella said firmly.
"Disputes between Alliance members must be settled by the Council."
"As my father and mother's dispute with Jalen was settled."
"That was not a dispute between the realms. Theirs was a personal attack made against a member of the House of Nyset on Sisian soil. Jalen had the right to administrate the laws of his city, just as you could enforce Parsathian law if he attempted to kill someone while in your territory."
"There was no attack. There are only lies."
Pella did not deny that.
"The incident has been investigated. By Alliance law, it is satisfied. All reports support Jalen's claim that his actions were justified, and he has also lost a son. Blood has been shed on both sides. To seek vengeance beyond the law is an affront to the gods."
"An affront to the gods?"
Maddox's harsh laugh echoed through the chamber.
"Only to your goddess. Her brother Shalik rages with me."
"So he does."
Her gaze was steely as it held his.
"But that is the way of justice. He serves himself, law serves the people, and it is by Alliance law that this matter has been resolved."
"Alliance law is not Parsathian law."
"Then by your own laws. If Jalen set upon your parents as you believe, then your queen and king were challenged and defeated. The council could have allowed Jalen to take Parsathian lands for his own, a suggestion that was at one point put forth by him."
Madoc might have welcomed that, for if it had been done, then Madoc would have soon been meeting Jalen and issuing a new challenge. And if it had been done, so too would the Alliance Council have met him on the battlefield.
You would have allowed him to take Parsathian lands?
The fury of his gaze burned into hers, and even steel could not long withstand heat of this intensity.
Parsathian lands are not the Council's lands to give. We are not a province under rule of the Alliance. The Alliance is an agreement between our people, and treachery breaks that agreement.
Pella and her devotion to Muda did not sit at that crescent table alone, however. Madoc met Nael's gaze again, and could see no weakening in the older man, nothing to distrust. Yet Jalen still lived.
You stand with this decision?
Grim resolution lined his face.
Our queen and king wanted nothing more than a strong alliance.
They were betrayed by that alliance. I have no more use for it.
You speak in haste and rage and grief.
Admonition firmed the other man's voice.
Your parents would still have the agreement between our people and the southern realms be honored.
Haste and rage and grief did not change the truth that prompted Madoc's response.
What honor is there when we stand in alliance with their murderers? Do you speak as their friend and fellow warrior? Do you speak as a Parsathian? Or do you speak for this council?
The older man's jaw clenched, likely holding back his own words of haste and rage. After a moment he said evenly,
I took a vow to serve our people and to serve this alliance, and I speak for both when I tell you we cannot weaken now.
Pella's gold chains clinked softly as she folded her arms over her chest, her eyes tight with dread and fear.
Word is that Anumuth the Destroyer is returning from across the Western Ocean.
Rumor.
Madoc dismissed. He had heard the same word. But not a day of his life had passed without hearing someone speculate upon the Destroyer's return.
This news has come from many sources,
Nael said quietly.
You were a babe too young to know the terror and evil he brought upon us, but Pella and I remember well. So do Kintus and Gareth. Now with the monasteries of Tola at our side, with the strength of Ephorn and Sissia, with Roguzian steel and Gogian seed, perhaps more might survive his march through these lands. More might live.
Bitterness rose to Madoc's tongue again.
What life would it be when every breath drawn is of air that Jalen still breathes? As a son, I cannot let their murders go unavenged. I cannot be part of an alliance that will turn their gaze from truth and say that justice has been done.
And what of your people? You are not only a son. You will be a king.
Parsath has not yet spoken.
They will, as one voice.
Nael's was certain.
You will be Ran Madoc, and we must have a king who does not put himself above the needs of the people by turning his back on the Alliance.
And Madoc could not turn his back on his mother and father.
Others could lead. Your daughter is strong. Enox would be a fine Ran.
She is, and she would be.
Nael agreed.
But so would many others. The tribes would argue and put forth their own candidates, and we would be divided instead of strengthened by the choice we must make. You are the only one who would have the consensus of all. You are the only one who already does. Do you think these discussions have not already taken place? They have. You are the voice we will choose to speak for all of Parsath, Madoc. And is this how you would serve us? Is this how you would honor your mother and father, by destroying the Alliance and abandoning your people?
It is Jalen who destroyed the Alliance when he struck my father down.
Not in the eyes of the law.
Pella's response was not without sympathy, but her gaze and her tone were steel again. And if you touch Jalen or his sons in retaliation, the Alliance will move against you as an enemy. Madoc inclined his head.
If that is what must be, then so be it.
On a heavy sigh, Nael closed his eyes, then looked to Pella with a silent request. She answered with a bow of her head and more solemn words for Madoc.
I will leave you to speak with your advisor, Ran Madoc. I understand what a blow this must strike to your heart. But the Alliance must survive if we are all to survive, and it cannot if your vengeance rips apart the agreement that binds us. No one will trust the Parsathians to hold to Alliance law if their Ran raises himself above it.
Your words are not unheard, Lady Pella,
was his only response. It was all Madoc could give to her now,
the reassurance that he respected her enough to hear and consider everything she had said. Upon her retreat, Nail sank heavily into one of the bone chairs. With a gesture, he invited Matic to do the same, but Matic could not sit. He prowled the length of the chamber instead.
Held and interrogated for 3 turns of the moon?
Matic would not lay accusing eyes upon the other man, so he looked to the ivory ceiling instead. If Nail had known what had occurred, his mother would never have been imprisoned for so long.
How did their absence go unnoticed?
We knew they were journeying in search of a bride.
Weary self-recrimination filled the response. This was a question Nail must have asked himself repeated times.
No one in Parsath thought them missing, only traveling. I thought their silence was unusual, but never suspected the truth. I believed they had simply not sent a message, or would not, until they found a bride for you.
What of this girl? There are no more daughters of Nyset, are there?
Only a woman of Nyset's blood could inherit Sissia's throne, which was why Jalen would never be more than regent, nor would his sons, despite the moonstone eyes that marked them as Nyset's descendants. Their own children would not carry the same mark. It only passed through the female line. Jalen's wife, the warrior queen Vysen, had given birth to 5 sons. But she had borne no daughters and was the last female in that bloodline. With no one to claim the throne after her death, Jalen clung to her power and his position with an iron fist. Nail shook his head.
A lure, perhaps. There have been whispers of a female heir, but I know no one who has seen her with their own eyes. I've spoken with a girl who claimed your father assaulted her. She is a cousin to their late queen, but through the male line. Nyset's blood does not run through her veins, and she has no claim on the throne. As a bride who would strengthen ties within the alliance, she would not have suited our queen and king's purpose. As a woman, she was too weak in spirit and body to have suited your parents' purpose, or you.
Another liar, then, though if weak in spirit, perhaps forced to lie by Jalen.
And the warriors who traveled with them?
A Parsathian queen or king was always accompanied by a dragon, 6 warriors whose only purpose was to protect the Ran and carry out her or his commands. As they had both been named Ran, his parents had 2 dragons.
Also sentenced for conspiring against the House of Nyset.
Sentenced?
Silenced, so they could not speak the truth of what happened.
Nail inclined his head in agreement.
That is often how Jalen quiets dissent within his city. It follows that he would do the same to them.
Our queen and king and 2 dragons murdered.
12 warriors who were also mothers and fathers, sons and daughters. Matic stopped pacing, his chest a ragged ache, his family silver crest burning around his thumb.
How can I let this remain unavenged? I cannot. You must. The Alliance has run its course if this corruption and betrayal can stand, and the Council stands with it, because nothing will stand if our allies cut our legs out from beneath us.
And what would you put in the Alliance's place? Warriors are stronger when they stand together, and Parsath is stronger if we stand with the southern realms, even if one of those realms is rotten.
Only one? With Ezel on Rugus's throne, Jalen's rot will not be contained within Sissia. And some say that Ezel is worse than his father.
Not only murdering his cousin to gain his throne, but also studying dark magics and seeking power through blood sacrifice.
These are the kings we stand with?
If we must,
Nail replied.
Kings rise and fall. It is not for them that we fight, but for the people who live under their rule.
That was the truth. So was Maddox's reply.
Then it would be better for all if I took Jalen's head.
And if your vengeance destroys the Alliance, then we will remake it anew.
For a long moment, only another heavy sigh was Nail's response. Then the older man said,
You will be my king, Matic. I hear your words, and I hope you hear mine when I advise you to not make any decisions in grief and rage. If you must vow to avenge them, I advise that you also do not speak an oath in haste. Silver-fingered Rani has taken your parents, so nothing can change their course. Only yours can be determined now.
And his course might determine the course of every Parsathian. Matic inclined his head. Though his heart yearned for blood, he could not deny the wisdom of the man's words.
Your journey home will pass through another full turn of the moon.
Nail continued.
Use that time to reflect upon the path you will take. That is my advice to you. Think hard and well upon your next steps.
I can promise that.
Another harsh laugh escaped him.
I know not how I will think of anything else.
Nor I. I have not these many days and nights.
A rueful smile curved Nail's thin mouth before a grave weariness flattened his expression again.
When you are Ran, you will speak for every Parsathian. Perhaps you should let every Parsathian guide your voice, for Ran Ashev and Ran Merrick were not only your parents but also our queen and king. When we gather, we can tell our brothers and sisters what befell them. We can tell them of the council's investigation and of the lies we suspect. We will tell them the consequences of vengeance and the threat of the destroyer. If they demand blood, I will stand with you.
That was also wise advice.
And if there is not a consensus?
Then it is your place as Ran to speak for us. We will abide by your decision. So think upon what it must be. Think upon it as a son and as a king.
He would try, but he was not a king yet, only a warrior. Now his warrior's heart grieved anew. His parents, too, had been warriors, and every warrior knew death would one day come. If not by steel, then by claw or plague or the ravages of age. Countless dangers could have befallen his parents. Before Matic had arrived in Ephorn, he hadn't known what danger it had been, but he could have accepted any of them. He could not accept treachery and dishonor. And Matic had believed that in the council's haste to send word, they simply forgot to tell the cause of his parents' death to the Tulehi captain who'd borne the message. But now Matic understood. If the queen and king had sickened or been attacked by bandits or become a meal for the fanged beasts that stalked the burning plains, such information would have been passed along too. But the council had not told Matic what Jalen had done, because they had not wanted him to charge north with the Parsathian army at his back and with vengeance burning in his heart. Yet vengeance burned hot anyway, and only one thought stoked the furnace of his mind. Someone would pay.
Chapter 3. Matic. With Pella's blessing and the resources of Ephorn at their disposal, the Parsathians made camp on the plain north of the walled city, where there was fresh water and ample grazing for the horses, and where the riders would be near enough to the city to enjoy its abundant pleasures. For 2 days and nights, naught but music and laughter and feasting filled the camp, but the meat tasted bitter and the meat like ashes, and Matic found no enjoyment in any of it. He could not begrudge his warriors' light hearts, however. A full turn of the moon had passed since the Parsathians had left the Lave encampment, and tomorrow morning would see the riders hard upon the road again. All preparations had been made, supplies renewed, mounts rested. Around the fire some warriors already slept. Others were intent on drinking and fucking until barrels and bodies ran dry, though the morning would come upon them doubly hard. Those at Matic's fire slept. Only he was awake, sitting upon his furs and staring into the flames until his eyes stung. At the base of his first finger now rested his father's silver crest, which Nail had retrieved from Sissia during the inquiry into the queen's and king's deaths. These crests were often all that were returned to a warrior's kin. As leader of the Parsathian army, Matic had collected hundreds of fallen warriors' rings and sent them north to the burning plains so their families would know that silver-fingered Rani had flown them into Temra's arms. Even now, within his first captain's satchel were dozens more, each one belonging to a Parsathian warrior killed while battling the Farians, and each night, as was the first captain's duty, Enox polished those rings until they gleamed. Nail had cared for Ran Merrick's in the same way, but never would the silver shine bright again. Age and use had scuffed the surface and worn thin the image stamped into the metal. A fire blooms petals, the mark of his father's tribe. When Matic had last seen it, Ran Ashev's crest was equally worn, the winged dragon of Ran Bantic's line no longer standing in sharp relief, its stamped edges dulled by time. That same dragon decorated Matic's own crest, its wings cradling a fire bloom, and on either side of the mark was etched his parents' names. But although his father's ring now circled his finger, his mother's did not lie beside it. Her family crest had not been among the belongings Jalen had returned to the Alliance Council,
though his mother's sword, shield, and the silver claws she wore into battle had been. Stolen, then. The thief king himself would not have taken a silver crest from a warrior's thumb, whether enemy or friend. Yet Jalen had dishonored his mother even in that small way, and Matic had been forbidden to raise his sword against him. Throat aching, he swept the pad of his thumb over his father's crest, remembering another night, another fire, and his father's words to him then. Wars are fought on battlefields, my son, yet it is in throne rooms where wars are lost or won. But his father had been wrong. Matic had spent the past 10 years upon battlefields, and he had won, battle after battle, season after season, until few threats to the Alliance remained, until even the savage